Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Before introducing my guest, I thought I'd make a comment on the passing of Nelson Mandela. Over the last 40 years or so, 50 years, three people have provided a model for me. One is Gandhi, one is Martin Luther King, and one is Nelson Mandela. They all have in common being freedom fighters. They all have in common an all-embracing view of the equality of human beings, a kind of cross-religion, cross-cultural, all-embracing acknowledgement that we're one family. Two of them died violent deaths. Mandela was given the privilege of living to a fine old age in his 90s, but of course spent 27 of his years in jail. Mandela is a wonderful example for those of us who work as therapists for the independence of the human spirit from its circumstances. Now, I think that all heroic figures actually confirm the independence of our human spirit from circumstance. Martin Luther King, with his ability to stand above racism, not only against African Americans, but against whites. Gandhi, of course, was very, very much the same. Forgiveness is also a major part of their lives. Martin Luther King was a Christian, of course, and deeply believed in forgiveness, I'm sure. And Mandela acted, which is far harder, acted the role of forgiveness. So just a passing, little effects of the weather, a little virus here, not a big one. And Mandela, with his survival in 27 years in prison and his transformation from believing in violence to believing in a more nonviolent approach, is a model of transformation, spiritual transformation, under the hardships of imprisonment and, I'm sure, incredible amounts of degradation and humiliation, which he would never even probably have wanted to share. It's hard to imagine him being treated in any other way, although as the years went on, I think his genuine transcendental qualities were recognized by the people he related to in jail as well. So just some thoughts. I hadn't actually expected to speak about this, but it occurred to me that this is just such an important thing. And, of course, we approach Christmas. These kinds of spiritual issues come to the forefront of our minds. Well, my guest today, I'm holding his book in my hands. Are you there, Enrico?
I am indeed, yes, Peter.
Oh, good. Well, I've got your book. I haven't had a chance to do more than look at it. It's a good book. It's called Back to Normal. why ordinary childhood behavior is mistaken for ADHD, bipolar disorder, and autism spectrum disorder. My guest is Enrico Nolatti. Let me pronounce, I pronounced his name not too well, Nolatti. The G is silent, and his last name is spelled G-N-A-U-L-A-T-I. G-N-A-U-L-A-T-I. And the book, again, Back to Normal, published by Beacon Press, which is an accomplishment. He has a short reference to me in the book, which is an accomplishment at Beacon Press, I think. Beacon Press is a good press that does a lot of interesting work, but it is certainly within the mainstream. And congratulations on getting published by Beacon Press. Enrico is a psychologist, clinical psychologist. He specializes in child and adolescent therapy. We'll be talking a lot about that today. He's published widely, and he's also been written about in a variety of interesting and worthwhile places. He approaches things, as you'll see, with perhaps not as sharp an axe as I do, but with a very critical acumen. So with that introduction, Enrico, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thanks for your kind words. And I should say that I'm genuinely honored to be on the show. I mean, I read your book, Toxic Psychiatry, back in when it came out in the early 90s. And I was a graduate student at Columbia University at the time. And I'd actually just finished getting a master's degree in existential phenomenological psychology. So reading your book, your voice is an ethical voice that has been in my head for many, many years, and believe it or not, in some small way, you know, influenced the writing of this book. You should know that.
No, that's wonderful. I've mentioned before, and I'll probably mention it every time, that one of the satisfactions, unexpected satisfactions from my doing this radio show is that folks whom I have not met, but whose work we've become familiar with and whom we invite on the show, 9 out of 10 times say something close to what Enrico Nolatti just said. And, of course, what a gratification for me, and I really appreciate that. Now, where would you like to begin? We had a lovely discussion about a lot of different issues. Where would you like to begin today?
Well, you know, maybe we can talk just in broad brushstrokes about these three disorders that I deal with in my book and kind of my arguments for why they're overdiagnosed. I mean, establishing that they are overdiagnosed and why. And, you know, the just some statistics that I can throw out there. These days, the latest statistics about what 1 in 10 children are considered to be ADHD, 1 in 88 kids with autism spectrum disorder, and then there's been a 40-fold increase in diagnoses of bipolar disorder in the past decade, 41% increase in ADHD, about 78% increase in diagnoses of autism spectrum disorder over the past decade. And my argument, just once again, purely at a statistical level, my argument for why these diagnoses that I would say are legitimate diagnoses but that are massively overdiagnosed are some other statistics. So, for instance, there's a study out of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill showing that upwards of 30% of two-year-olds diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder no longer meet the criteria for the disorder by the time they hit age 4. So you've got like possibly as many as a third of kids going off the spectrum. ADHD, there's a study out of NIMH showing that about 75% of children diagnosed with ADHD by the time they hit their mid-20s no longer fit the criteria for the disorder. And then there's another study showing that upwards of 35% of kids diagnosed with bipolar disorder in their mid-20s no longer fit the criteria for the disorder. And my point of view would be, if we've got such high percentages of kids shedding these diagnoses, which are supposed to be, you know, lifelong debilitating conditions, then we have to wonder if the diagnosis applied in the first place. So I thought I'd just hit your listeners with some statistics there, just to kind of get a sense of perspective about, you know, these diagnoses.
Well, and the data on, I'm sure you know, if you just focus in on high school boys,
mm-hmm.
your data for being diagnosed ADHD is in the 20% range, not the 1 in 10, but the 2 in 10% range.
Yeah, and believe it or not, Peter, and it's sort of, you could say absurd, but when you start to kind of think deeply about it, it's not so absurd. The rates of ADHD diagnosis vary radically across the country. So for instance, a study came out last week out of CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, showing that the state with the lowest percentage of, supposedly the lowest percentage of ADHD kids is Nevada with 4.2, versus I believe it's Kentucky with something like 14%. And so you've got these, you know, massive discrepancies depending on what state you happen to exist in, and, you know, the infrastructure in that state, the diagnostic infrastructure and whatnot. So, you know, that's also interesting information.
And internationally, in
mm-hmm.
France, it's almost non-existent.
Yeah.
So the variation is quite huge. I suspect that if we could get to dig deep enough, it has a great deal to do with the variations, with the success of pharmaceutical industry
mm-hmm.
Control over the prescribers in any given
mm-hmm.
place.
I think that's a fact. There's another interesting correlated data point. I don't want to get too bogged down in data here because there's a lot more interesting ideas that we could discuss. But if you, I'm sort of gearing up to write an article looking at how the different rates of ADHD across the country almost mirror the amount of recess time that a kid gets. So, for instance, the region of the country with the highest number of ADHD kids is in the southeastern states, which has the least amount of recess time. And then the western states has the most amount of recess time during the elementary school years. They have the least amount of ADHD diagnosis. So I was going to make this fancy argument for kind of, you know, the role of recess and active play experiences and governing these diagnoses. I mean, there's also fairly good arguments that have been made showing that it has a lot to do with the No Child Left Behind laws that were passed over a decade ago, that they were implemented more quickly in the eastern states and then made their way across the country, so much so that within 4 years of the No Child Left Behind Act being passed, there was a 22% spike in the rates of ADHD across the country. The argument being is that, you know, the increase in diagnoses had to do with placing a lot of new organizational demands, academic demands on children, performance demands on children that were outside of their developmental capacities. In fact, there's a study by Todd Elder at Michigan State University even showing that he demonstrated that probably as many as a million kindergartners across the country are falsely diagnosed with ADHD just as an artifact of them being the youngest in age in kindergarten and the most immature in kindergarten and unable to just cope with the new academic pressures placed on kindergartners.
This is all good data. I actually think it's very, very important to remind folks about the details of this data.
Here, just quickly, I mean, I would argue that the main reason that these diagnoses are being overdiagnosed has to do with how similar the symptoms of them are to run-of-the-mill childhood behaviors, and that's what my book's all about. You know, so for instance, you know, with ADHD, you know, the so-called symptoms of distractibility, forgetfulness, difficulties following through with directions, difficulties waiting your turn, over-talking, these are all run-of-the-mill childhood phenomena that all children have to struggle with. And so, you know, how do you differentiate between just a struggling child in these areas and a mildly ADHD child, for instance? And the same applies to, you know, autism spectrum disorder, you know, like symptoms like not responding when your name is called, not engaging in eye contact, you know, difficulties transitioning, appearing kind of self-absorbed in a rote activity, you know, being verbally reticent, you know, not talking and appearing shut down and remote. These are fairly common, and if you throw in other soft criteria like tantruming and picky eating and all the things that in our culture we tend to throw in, you know, when we talk about spectrum behavior, you know, it's hard to differentiate a mild case of autism spectrum disorder then and just a struggling toddler.
And a lot of the symptoms, particularly for ADHD, are in fact simply a list of symptoms that tick off teachers. They're the things, and I think that's how the drug companies tailored. I think they clearly got together with their school psychology people, and they inventoried the behaviors in a classroom that require a teacher's attention, and that's your list of ADHD. And many of them are so tailored for school that they mention school.
There you go.
Interrupts the teacher before she's finished asking her question, things like this, squirms in seat. These are actually specific for school. And I really do think it's the kids who aren't fitting into the coercive setting of the school for whatever reason. Now, I don't think that any of these disorders have validity. So I don't think it's a matter of, you know, where does the normal go to the abnormal? I think it's a matter of, you know, is the child having a problem and we need to find out the kid's having a problem, or is it the teacher's problem or the parent's problem? And the solution always lies in the adults, either accepting what is the child's normal behavior for that child or helping the child grow. Do you still harbor beliefs that these things at one point or another become valid when they're extreme?
If you held my feet to the fire, I would say yes, Peter. And my view of them is probably more of a, now I'm going to get kind of intellectual on you, more of a sort of evolutionary functionalist viewpoint. So, for instance, for a kid that shows dysfunctional levels of, like, in other words, if what's being demanded of them within all the environments in which they exist matched against their impulse control, their mood, and so on and so forth, results in a kid who's perpetually struggling across environments, and, you know, then I would say we've got a child who's sort of dysfunctional for one reason or another, and so, you know, and if they're dysfunctional for reasons having to do with impulse control, forgetfulness, difficulty staying organized in their thinking and their behavior, then I would say, okay, that we've got an ADHD kid on our hands, perhaps. But there's always that part of me that likes to think, this kid, if we could construct the ideal home environment for this kid or construct the ideal school environment for this kid, would these so-called symptoms then disappear? You know, it's a sort of a complicated answer to your questions, but I do believe that they do exist, but I think that they're much more rare than we think, you know.
Well, let me, do you mind having a conversation about this? Because I think it's very important that to get two sides on the show, which people often don't get because, you know, a lot of my guests, it's pretty much we're talking from such a similar wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the key here is that your viewpoint, you're withholding the complete indictment, permits mm-hmm. you to get published in standard presses. And I think that's kind of one of the really big issues that we face. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've gotten published in a number of very standard presses over the years,
mm-hmm.
but it's always a fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had my books come out from Perseus and St. Martin's and so on. Whereas if I held back just as much as you are, let's say,
mm-hmm.
I'd have no trouble getting published at all,
mm-hmm.
probably.
You should know, I mean, my perspective is not a political one in that regard. It actually reflects my true thinking that these
are
the
I believe that, and I'm not accusing you of being a manipulator. I want to emphasize that actually the difference in the position you take, though, has a huge political differences.
Sure.
The other thing is I think it's very important to distinguish between diseases and a normal distribution curve. That even if what you're saying is right, that some children are born with more difficulty accommodating classrooms, let's say,
mm-hmm.
I have no doubt about that. No place in the history of humanity until a few thousand, very, very recently, actually, did we ask children to sit down, shut up, and be in a room all day long?
Mm-hmm.
We were not evolved to do that at all. There's no
mm-hmm.
place in our evolution because we evolved to who we are today, 150,000, 200,000 years ago. There weren't any classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we were living in families and clans. There was probably a huge amount of more freedom in what the children did, and also apparently, if you look back, a lot more nurturing and input in these
mm-hmm.
Small family clan situations.
Mm-hmm.
But I hear you saying that then enables us to say that the kids who really were made for clan situations and family situations and they're not making it in the industrial school, we'll call them ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cop-out on calling the school an industrial age school, which doesn't meet the needs of children.
No, I get that, but you can. I would argue that you can only transform classrooms, schools, and classrooms so much. You can only transform perhaps teaching styles so much. And I think there's definitely a need there to try to have a more enlightened view of it and trying, you know, even simple things, though, Peter, like just having more recess time. I mean, I remember I was born and raised in Scotland and came through the Scottish education system, which, you know, is far more, at least back in the 60s when I was a kid, far more rigid and far use of corporal punishment and, you know, very, you know, rigid codes of conduct required of kids and uniforms. This is Catholic school in Glasgow, Scotland in the 60s. And what made that psychologically possible for me to sit in a classroom was knowing that, you know, at 10:15 in the morning, I'd be out on the playground. I'm a little guy. I'd be on top of one of the big guys' backs, and we would be piggyback fighting, wrestling, rolling around on the ground, hooting and hollering and giggling and laughing and aggressing, and then you kind of you pulled yourself together after having that wonderful regressive experience, and you got back into the classroom, and it was psychologically possible to face those sort of rigid realities. And so in our country right now, even if something as simple as sort of recess and how and the kind of play that we will allow on the playground, I would say that those factors alone set the conditions for a certain percentage, especially of boys, and we should talk about that at some point in time, just these the gender differences in the diagnoses, but set the conditions up for many boys just getting falsely diagnosed with ADHD in particular.
Well, I think your points are all good, and I'm tempted to continue to look at where we agree and disagree, because I think this is a rare opportunity for people. See, I would say that we kind of basically agree on the whole issue, but that the language that you want to give the kids who are having more trouble adjusting is a medicalized language, which has no place in this.
But I don't know what the alternative is, Peter. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I will often use a diagnosis for political reasons, even though it... So in other words, there's this absurd reality that I find myself in my practice oftentimes with kids, where on the surface they meet the criteria for something like ADHD, but they don't really have it. They don't really have it. But if putting it on paper in a report somewhere gets them the services they need in a school system that's not going to change anytime soon, and helps them preserve their academic record, which then in turn keeps options open for them from college and whatnot, then the diagnosis is, there's an argument made for ethical, practical, political reasons, is useful to get a kid necessary service just to kind of get them through the school system until they've got maturation behind their behind them and changing life circumstances, where the diagnosis then, or any mention of the diagnosis, becomes totally irrelevant.
I want to pick up on that issue at the half hour. We've got about two or three minutes. I want to respond to this it. See, the language that you come back to is, do they have it or not? And scientifically and philosophically and logically, there is no it. There is no medical syndrome of ADHD. At best, there's a spectrum of the behaviors that children have, and that those are vastly influenced, not just by evolution, obviously, but by cultural evolution and then by child rearing. So it's no place in all of this is there a medical, scientific, diagnostic it, probably for anything in psychiatry, including the bipolar and autism spectrum disorder in children. And that if we don't directly say that, we continue to leave open the giving children the idea they have diseases, giving children the idea that they have disorders, and giving children the idea they can't really control themselves, and opening up the way to medication. Because when you give that diagnosis, you're almost guaranteeing the kids are going to end up on drugs that are going to harm their brains and their lives.
Well, and I guess, Peter, I both agree and disagree. I mean, maybe the way you're defining disease as a strictly brain-based or medical entity versus someone who's, like we go with dis, whose level of dis-ease is such that because of their, personality makeup, some combination of their personality makeup, temperament, learned ways of behaving over time, in most contexts that involve love and work, getting along with other people, making relationships work, having a productive work experience, if that, in most circumstances, they run into extreme difficulties, then I would say that that's a diseased person. I'm just defining disease perhaps differently than you are, in a more functionalist way, yeah.
Well, the problem is that it will then be treated as a disease and drugs will be given. We're going to go to break in a minute. I think this is interesting. Enrico, my guest is Enrico Nolati, and his last name is spelled G-N-A-U-L-A-T-I. His book is Back to Normal. It's really interesting for me to be able to have a reasonable discussion about these differences. If you're comfortable with that, I'd continue it after the break.
Certainly.
Great. All right. Well, we'll go to break. Back to Normal. Enrico Nolati, PhD, clinical psychologist. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and you are, of course, listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. My guest, Enrico Nolatti, spelled G-N-A-U-L-A-T-I. He's a PhD clinical psychologist out on the West Coast. His book is Back to Normal. We're having a really, to me, interesting discussion in that we're talking about differences, but in a very thoughtful and cordial way, and we have probably a larger area of agreement and disagreement. The way I see some of the disagreement is that Enrico takes a practical view that that there are differences between children and adaptational problems to the stresses of modern life, and that it can be useful to see some of them, not a large number, having diagnoses like ADHD and bipolar disorder and autism spectrum disorder, and that in particular getting them services, it's a requirement to get services in the schools that the kids need, in terms of getting them these diagnoses. And I'll let him in a second elaborate on if I've not done a fair job. And my view would be that, well, first, the diagnoses are fake. They don't exist. They've been made up by drug companies and psychiatric organizations to empower the psychological psychiatric establishment, but mainly to create markets for the drug companies. That's almost 90% probably a marketing by the drug companies issue. And that getting these labels robs the children of their autonomy, gives them a negative view of themselves. And as Ginger and I are discovering as we're following up the literature more and more, ultimately makes them gateway children, gateway into the mental health system, leading eventually to other psychiatric drugs, the antipsychotic drugs, and disastrous physical and psychological and social circumstances. The ADHD children we're following up have huge rates of hospitalization, criminality, drug addiction, obesity, and so on, because many of them have ended up with multiple psychiatric diagnoses and drugs. So, whoa, there's a little summary. Mm-hmm. Do you want to elaborate on your view a little more?
That's fine. You know, it might be useful to kind of talk about what in my book, Back to Normal, I you know, one of the chapters is on the abnormalizing of boys.
Yes,
which I think
that
is a little.
We'll have total agreement on that, probably.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, Fred, I mean, just quickly some statistics. About 1 in 54 boys now are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. It's about 5 times the rate of girls. ADHD is diagnosed in boys at about 3 times the rate of girls. 75% of students labeled emotionally disturbed and referred for special education are boys. And, you know, I think in my book I argue that we really need to do a better job as a society about trying to perhaps have a different system for thinking about what's normal in boys versus what's normal in girls. And I think what's happening right now in our culture is that a lot of traditional masculine behaviors are getting, you know, pathologized. And I think in particular it comes into play actually around autism spectrum disorder in the early years. So for instance, there's some little, you know, like with autism spectrum disorder, you know, there's this fancy term that autistic kids lack a theory of mind. In other words, you know, they lack an ability to kind of decipher. One way of defining that would be to decipher other kids or other people's intentions from their outward behavior, or read faces or read behavior for signs of what another person might be thinking or doing. But there's studies that show that, you know, in the toddler years, when most kids these days are diagnosed with autism, that it's not until about age five that boys and girls have more or less equal abilities in mind reading. So at age three and four, girls are about twice as capable as boys at mind reading. And then when it comes to pretend play, it's not until about age five that boys and girls draw equal in terms of their interest in pretend play. Forget about their capacities and the richness of their pretend play, but just their interest in pretend playing. So it's much more normative for a toddler male toddler age three or four to be absorbed in an activity that involves an object or objects rather than people, and to get great delight out of stacking blocks or lining up trains and doing it over and over and over again to acquire a sense of mastery. And the boys in those toddler years, more often than not, are less attracted to what's called affiliative play. In other words, playing animatedly with peers their age. That's more true of girls than boys. So if we don't understand, and then even it's been shown that, like, with empathy, it's supposedly autistic children, not supposedly, but children who meet the true criteria for that disorder lack empathy, an emotional resonance with others. But, you know, there are giant gaps between boys and girls, especially in those early years, in empathic capacities. And in fact, at birth, it's been shown that female infants will stare for much longer at faces rather than avert eye contact like boys are more likely to do. So these autistic phenomena dovetail with certain kind of traditional masculine tendencies, so that if you don't have a concrete sense of them, you can confound a mild case of autism spectrum disorder with just a toddler behaving in a traditionally masculine way. And that's especially true, and I get into this in my book, Back to Normal, if you happen to be a toddler male who's on the introverted end, who prefers aloneness and solitude over social engagement, and if you happen to be a boy who's in the mentally gifted arena, especially early signs of visual spatial intelligence. So, you know, that is one of the topics that I address in my book, where these confounds. And the ADHD realm, you know, I think one of the reasons that ADHD gets assigned more frequently to boys than girls is because of essentially our discomfort with accepting aggression in boys and boys' need for aggressive play. In fact, when it comes to pretend play, it's the main way in which boys, and this has been showing cross-culturally, will engage in pretend play is through war play and rough and tumble play. And I would say that these are archetypal forms of play that if we frown upon them and deny boys opportunities to engaging that style of play, that we disallow them the outlets that they need to have better self-regulation, which will make them more restless, impulsive little beings in general, and at risk for a false diagnosis of ADHD. So, you know, it may be in our culture that we're using standards of behavior that are normative for the average girl and superimposing them on boys. And that part of the reason, and this is, you know, this is just my point of view, part of it may be that because most of the professionals or adult professionals who are making judgments about whether or not a diagnosis applies with a child these days happen to be female. So about 75% of teachers these days are women. That's the highest it's ever been since statistics were gathered by the National Education Association. The majority of pediatricians are women, about 53%, up from 20% in the 70s. Upwards of 72% of psychologists are women. Upwards of 80% of social workers are women. So, and not that I'm espousing a sexist point of view, I would be saying that perhaps Not for malicious reasons, not for discriminatory reasons, but just in terms of their gender viewpoint. A woman might, you know, women in positions of authority and judgment making when it comes to diagnostic decisions may have we'll call it a benign bias in terms of what they think ought to be normal with children. And that may, and it may be that we need to do more in our society, and we need to do more when we're educating health and mental health professionals to really address the gender issue. What's normative for boys in this day and age? What's normative for girls? And kind of factoring that in any kind of diagnostic judgment-making process.
Well, first, thank you for changing the subject away from our differences, because you have just filled one of the most important 10 or 12 minutes has ever been on my show.
Oh, wow.
This material, this brief description that you've just given is incredibly important, and it's a whole chapter about this in his book, Back to Normal, in Enrico's book, Back to Normal. I'd like you to actually repeat the very beginning. The data is astonishing on how much difference there is in the diagnosis of the children for autism. The difference there that you quoted was very large, boys versus girls. Mm-hmm. Something I didn't even know. What was that figure?
1 in 54 boys. That's the current data set out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
And girls, it's...
I think it's like 1 in 250 or something like that, but it's about five times the rate in boys.
Five times the rate.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. It makes complete sense from what you're saying. And we know that over the years, the rate for ADHD was 9 to 1, mm-hmm. but they've been shortening it by including more of the dreamy type stuff, inattention.
There you go. But in the special education system and our school system, they're overwhelming number of referrals for special education due to emotional disturbance or for boys. And if you look at expulsion rates, actually, if you look at, as absurd as it sounds, if you look at expulsion rates in preschool and kindergarten, the numbers are massive. So, the numbers of boys who are getting suspended and expelled from preschool and kindergarten and first grade due to aggressive acts has just skyrocketed. It's like we've become sort of intolerant, really, of sort of aggressive play, is what I would argue. And I think it's very difficult for educators to just work with that behavior, even when it's problematic, instead of extinguishing it or just to work with it. I actually just wrote an article that's come out in a magazine called Play Therapy. It's titled something like The Therapeutic Uses of Rough and Tumble Play, where I'm trying in my own way as a child psychologist to push the boundaries of what's acceptable in the therapist's office. And a lot of what I do is work physically with boys. Using physical play, for therapeutic purposes.
Well, everything you're saying, I think, is incredibly important. Talk some about what you think happens to these boys who are raised in the presence of suppressive attitudes toward masculinity or towards normal boy behavior, what do you call it? Do you call it masculinity or?
You know, it's so hard because that sounds so kind of archaic. I mean, I got my undergraduate degree in American studies, back in the mid-80s, where it was anathema to talk about gender and so I to this day, I fear the gaze of the harsh gaze of a professor whenever I start using words like masculinity. But you know what? We got to get more comfortable as a society doing that. Like, hey, he's just behaving like most boys do. Or he's not that discursive. He kind of, it takes him a while to warm up, and he's mostly social when he's around other kids of the same interests as he does, and then he lights up. And, you know, in that regard, he's kind of like a normal boy, or you know, the average boy. I mean, I think we need to build those kind of phrases into our discourse. Or he's, disorganized. His room's looks like a rat's nest. The homework is sticking out of the book, so he forgot to hand it in, even though he finished it. Yep, he's behaving like an average boy his age. Why don't you just give him, you know, tell him he needs to hand in his homework tomorrow by 9 o'clock instead of giving him an F for that assignment.
What do you see as the long-term effects on boys and on our culture from this process of suppressing manly behavior?
I mean, it's a sort of a big question, Peter. I mean, I think that in general, it disallows boys what have been kind of historic outlets to just at a basic primal level to learn to regulate their own aggressive impulses, to get some distance from them, to have expressive outlets, to just acquaint themselves with their own aggression so that they don't need to act it out. So expressive mastery when it comes to, you know, when they're in an aggressive state of mind, you know, all of that can then lead to kind of quirky, you know, like ADHD type phenomena, I would argue, that they're more restless, squirmy, fidgety, distractible. You know, so it can, you know, the one can lead to the other, I would say.
And I think the other side of the coin, I don't know if you address this in your book, is that, in fact, these standards of excessive standards of self-discipline and being non-aggressive and being cooperative and so on actually afflict girls and women too, because certainly a major issue we see in adult society and in doing therapy with adults is women who, even in this day and age, have been quite suppressed in their ability to be confrontational and aggressive, and then that becomes being unable to be assertive. And I work with women who are very professional people, lawyers, physicians in my practice, and most of them struggle with the rejection of this aspect of being a girl and then an adult.
No, I am completely on board with that idea, and that, in combination with what I said, to me, ought to move as a society in the direction of, in the early years, preschool, kindergarten, having a kind of a wellness model rather than a mental wellness rather than mental illness model, where we have social skills group for kids, where we're helping kids deal with struggles, you know, sharing, cooperating, getting along, asserting themselves in forthright ways. Be you a boy, be you a girl. I think that if we moved in that direction, we'd see a giant drop-off in these diagnostic trends. So in other words, having a component, to a mental wellness component to children's early education that focuses on their social and emotional development.
That would be a wonderful ideal. The problem I've seen in my many, 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 many decades in the field now is as soon as you introduce into the schools anything that remotely looks like psychological or psychiatric interventions, it's oppressive in the worst degree. So while I agree that that would be a lovely thing, I'm afraid that it would be quickly co-opted and we'd be just diagnosing and drugging the kids even more. But I certainly agree in principle that that would be a lovely idea. I think parents need to have a heck of a lot more influence on the schools, and we need to have parents more and more taking charge of the schooling their children get. and we need to be encouraging the culture, the whole culture, to move in the direction you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Frank, and now I'm going to sound a little bit cynical about this, and frankly, you know, advocates and spokesperson like maybe you, like yourself and myself, who are not representing the interests of other entities. So, for instance, my fear of a wellness model of the sort that I just described being implemented in schools is then that schools would just build relationships with universities and researchers that would then, you know, now that's a whole other set of issues where then the researchers are just, implementing perhaps programs that are research-friendly and researchable and to generate funding sources and so on and so forth.
And a lot of very well-intentioned psychology, you know, emphasizing cooperative behavior, has really contributed to this emasculization. So it's really complicated as to how to implement any kind of a change.
Yeah, it really is difficult. I mean, some of the most difficult situations that I find myself in clinically these days are not with authoritarian parents who wield a big club in their parental role, but with permissive parents who feel like everything should be talked out and talked through, and that somehow a light bulb should go off in a child's head if something is said just the right way at the right time, that they'll have this insight and change their behavior, which, you know, and meanwhile, their children are running circles around them. Those are difficult situations to get a parent to realize that discipline, authoritativeness, clear boundaries, enforcement of those, risking conflict, risking your child hating you in the moment, are all part of what it means to be a virtuous parent.
Well, we see very closely eye to eye. In one of my books, Talking Back to Ritlin, when I was trying to figure out what couple of things could I really say to parents about changing their behavior, I talked about parents regaining or taking moral authority.
Children
need us to be the moral authorities in their lives, and the schools have lost that too.
Yeah. Even you know, the final chapter in my book, Back to Normal, is titled Parenting with Authority.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, so
there it is.
I mean, in terms of that, and frankly, there's an argument there. I think for ADHD in certain and high percentage of cases as being the result of a breakdown in authority at various levels in our society, teachers getting the authority, the true authority to discipline kids, parents feeling like they have the authority to discipline kids, and kids, you know, are getting the boundaries that they need, being required to follow through with expectations in healthy ways, the absence of these kinds of traditional teaching practices and parenting practices, I think, has, you know, contributed to, in some way, to the spike in ADHD diagnoses.
Absolutely. How do people get in touch with you?
I have an unusual name. You know, first name Enrico, E-N-R-I-C-O, last name G-N-A-U-L-A-T-I. If they were to Google me, they will find all sorts of information on me. I have a website. It's drnaulati.net. So it's dr.naulati, G-N-A-U-L-A-T-I.net. And there's a way to contact me through my website.
This has been a very, very interesting half hour. So one of the few times in my life I'm a little ambivalent about how I conducted the show. I thought the first half was quite interesting in kind of parsing these differences, but the second half, incredibly informative, unleashing you to talk about these issues with the raising of our boys. Next week, listeners, entirely by chance, I'm going to be on this topic again. My guest next week is a professor who specializes in the issues surrounding boys. His name is Miles Groth. I don't know if you've come across him.
I haven't. I'm writing his name down right now, Miles Groth.
And he's going to be talking about the issues of empowering boys. He actually teaches, he says, one of the few courses on it in the university. These will be two good back-to-back shows.
Wow.
We're going to be finishing in a minute. Have you got literally a minute you want to finish with? So maybe sum up what you think about boys and what's going on.
Is it about boys in particular? I mean, I think that we, you know, I would say that, that for parents of boys, I'm trying to think of something I could say that might
be memorable. We're going to be finishing.
Oh, okay.
I just sprung that on you.
Be more tolerant of their aggression or their enjoyment of aggressive play. There you
Perfect.
Go.
And their self-assertiveness.
And their self-assertiveness.
And remember, you can always lead a child gently. You rarely have to confront them. We can usually outwit them and not have to win over and beat them down and win conflicts. Raising children is a matter of unconditional love, good, solid discipline, and just a lot of patience. Raising kids, hardest job in the world. Hardest job, takes all that we have. Enrico Noapti, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure, Peter.
Thank you.